Hi, I'm Linda Mather. In this presentation, I will be sharing with you my experience and knowledge of working with clients in the substance misuse field. The aims of this training is to offer an understanding of substances, why people use substances, and ways in which you, the therapist, can work with clients in the substance misuse field. The objectives of the course is that you will have a deeper understanding of substances. You will be able to identify areas in which you may be able to support clients in recovery. And you will have tools and techniques to support clients in working towards abstinence. I am Linda Mather. I've been a counsellor for just over 20 years. And 11 of those years I've been with the NHS working in the substance misuse field. I'm also a trainer of counselling courses from introduction level right up to level 4 and 5. I'm also a clinical supervisor and also an author of counselling textbooks for students on training, self-help books for clients and counsellors, novels and children's books. I currently work generically in a GP practice 2 days a week. I do some private practice. And the rest of my time, if I have any, I do some writing. Firstly, I will explain to you the different types of substances. The stimulants, depressants, and hallucinogenics. Stimulants are usually amphetamine, ecstasy, cocaine, crack, legal highs. Also, alcohol can be a stimulant for some and a depressant for others. And equally, one day when you drink alcohol, it can be a stimulant, and another day it can be a depressant. Under the heading of depressants comes cannabis and heroin, and hallucinogenics come drugs like LSD and magic mushrooms. There are, of course, many more drugs on the market today, including the new zombie drugs. However, I believe treatment would be much the same. Firstly, we'll look at stimulants and what they actually do. They work on the neurological system, so they speed or stimulate the central nervous system in the brain. And they give the user a sense of euphoria, and this is due to the following. If you can imagine that inside our brain we have a neurotransmitter, and we'll call that the giver of pleasure. And also there's a receptor, and we'll call that a receiver of pleasure. Each time that we experience something good in our life, the neurotransmitter, the giver of pleasure, briefly goes into the receptor, the receiver of pleasure, and releases some endorphins, and we'll call them happy bubbles. And this leaves you with a feeling of a sense of euphoria. Many things can do this: a first date, a party, birthdays, Christmas coming, chocolate, new job, win on the bingo, holiday, sex, etc. Each time that we experience something pleasurable, this is what happens. Stimulants, however, they stop the neurotransmitter, the giver of pleasure, from coming out of the receptor. It holds it in for a lot longer and releases a full load of the endorphins. So emptying the bubble bag, so to speak, so you've no longer got endorphins in your system. And this is what gives the user a big high and a sense of euphoria. And this is also why stimulant users experience a massive crash when they come down off the drug. They will have no happy bubbles left. And although they will rejuvenate, it could take a couple of days to sometimes a month or so. And this is why this client group may often present with symptoms of depression after they've used the drug. With some drugs, such as crack cocaine, the client may present with extreme anxiety. We now move on to depressants. Depressants are substances which slow down the normal function of the central nervous system. And these drugs include barbiturates, benzodiazepines and alcohol, heroin, cannabis, and some inhalants are also depressants. The use of depressants can result in a slowed pulse and breathing, slurred speech, drowsiness, lowered blood pressure, poor concentration, fatigue and confusion, as well as impaired coordination, memory, and judgment. Clients describe the experience of this drug as floating on a cloud without a care in the world. It's a chilling out that they can't get by any other means. All their problems disappear and they have a calming effect. Some clients have also experienced a sense of being out of control and not liking the actual sensation. They often decrease painful emotions and irrational and negative thoughts. They calm down the mind. And last but not least, hallucinogens. The term hallucinogen refers to a variety of substances which are capable of inducing profound altered states of consciousness. These substances have a long history of use in societies throughout the world. And some of you may have read on the internet or heard that some therapists are now using hallucinogens to help clients get in touch with their inner consciousness. They induced a hyper-suggestible state. To be general, hallucinogens are psychoactive drugs. They produce altered perceptions or ways of thinking and feeling when taken. They alter the way you perceive the world around you and are said to expand the mind, that is, turn off your brain's selective perception function and allow you to perceive everything around you in a more intense and colourful way. And not just see, it also sound, taste, everything is heightened when people use hallucinogens. There are many reasons why people use substances. In my experience, it's to manage emotional and psychological pain, trauma, to manage mental health issues, anything from depression right up to schizophrenia and more serious mental health issues, and physical health too. Physical pain. The National Institute on Drug Abuse states that people take drugs for a number of reasons. To feel good, the euphoric effect. To feel better, to manage stress, anxiety, and depression. Sometimes to do better, to improve sports, schoolwork, etc. And lastly, curiosity and social pressure to impress friends. The difficulty with using drugs to self-medicate, whether that be for physical health, emotional health, psychological or psychiatric health, is that the drug use will inevitably increase over time because their tolerance to the drug changes. The longer that they use, the more that they will need to get the same effect. Find that they need more of the drug to get the same effect, which can become very costly, much more expensive than prescription charges and or therapy. When people first use a drug, they may perceive what seem to be positive effects, and they can also believe that they can control their use. Often, those positive effects turn to negative effects, and they can't control their use. Drugs can easily take over a person's life. Over time, all their other pleasurable activities, all the things that they used to enjoy, become less pleasurable, and the person has to take the drug just to feel normal. There are many skills needed when working with this client group. Some of the most important ones we'll be covering today. Empathy, core conditions, also self-esteem work, also exploring with the client why do they use drugs and what their triggers to their drugs are. We will also look at a CBT technique to work with this client group. CBT was once the evidence-based model that the NICE guidelines recommended for working with addictions. However, a more integrative approach is often now used. The important thing is that this type of work is often directive, particularly when working towards change. We'll be looking at alternative coping strategies, reduction plans, ambivalence and sabotage, also taking a history questionnaire and a timeline, and the underlying issues to the client's substance misuse. The most important thing that we can offer this client group, and I hope that we offer it all clients in our work, but for this client group, it's really, really important, and that's empathy and understanding. Most people in the drug user's life will not show this, and society in general are not accepting of them, and they will have had all the lectures they need from family and friends. So after listening to their story, you may say, "Oh, I'm not surprised you've turned to drugs. I'm guessing for you it is a coping strategy." This is the first time the client may have heard this level of understanding, and the connection begins, the relationship begins. As well as empathy, we need to ensure that we remain non-judgmental. Again, this client group will have had all the judgments they can cope with. And last but not least, congruence. Be honest. I'm not sure that it's been a healthy coping strategy for you. What are your thoughts? The core conditions need to be a thread through all your work together to help engage and connect with the client, because this client group do not engage or connect very well. This client group inevitably have a low self-esteem. If they didn't have one before their drug use, they develop one during their drug substance misuse journey. This will be from the names they've been called, the media's view of users, and society's view of drug users. So after offering the core conditions, I will thread self-esteem work through my work with them. And on the first session, or maybe the second, I will use this tool. And this tool can be used with any client with a low self-esteem. But remember, clients often use substances when they are feeling bad about themselves. This is a tool that you can do yourself. So if you want to pause the training and have a go at this, I always find that you see the powerfulness of tools if you try them yourself. So take a piece of A4 paper and put a line down the middle. On the left-hand side, I want you to write down 5 people that you admire. They can be friends, family. You can have one celebrity or icon. And you can have someone who is no longer with us. We're always mindful that there's good and bad in everybody, and we're looking at the good qualities that these 5 people have. And as you can see, I've got Anne, Emma, Paul, Claire, and Deb. Now I'd like you to write down on the right-hand side 3 things that you admire about these people. However, you cannot use the same quality twice. So as you can see on my copy, I've got Anna, Emma, Paul, Claire, and Deb. And the 3 things I admire about Anne is caring, she's straightforward, she's brave. Emma is good sense of humour, empathic, assertive. Paul is kind, helpful and chatty. Claire, loyal, fun and spirited. Deb is fun, spirited, honest, laid back and calm. So what the client has in front of them, or what you have in front of them if you've joined in this exercise, are 15 qualities. Tear the paper in half. Put the left-hand side in the bin, or in your handbag if you want to keep it, or your pocket, and write, "I am" at the top. You would tell the client that they now have their quality list in their hand, because it is impossible to recognize these qualities in others if you do not have them yourself. So I am caring, straightforward, brave, good sense of humor, empathic, assertive, kind, helpful, chatty, loyal, fun, spirited, honest, laid back, and calm. So read out what you are. You can show the client that the whole of him or her is not just a drug user. They have many other qualities too. And you could help him to draw out this diagram of all the qualities. And as you notice, the drug user is in the right-hand bottom corner in black. It's just that part of him. Many drug users feel that it's the whole of them. The whole of them is the drug user, and you're showing that actually it's not. It's just a small behavior. They have all these and other wonderful qualities. And then you can ask your client to turn their quality list into a poster and put around the house. Put one on the fridge, one on the wardrobe door, one above the bathroom mirror, anywhere in the house, one on the desk at work. And each time they feel bad about themselves, invite them to read it. If our washing machine breaks down, what do we do? Fix it? No. We troubleshoot first, get to the bottom of what is wrong with it. If we try to fix it without troubleshooting, then we risk it going wrong again. It is the same with life and the same with drug use. We need to troubleshoot first. If we don't troubleshoot and the client stops, then they're at high risk of relapse. The first thing we need to know is, why do they use drugs? Every client will use for a different reason. And so I will ask the client to finish off my sentence, and I will say to him or her, I use drugs because, and they may say to manage my anger. And I won't stop at there, because there may be several reasons, and I'll repeat, I use drugs because, to manage my stress. I use drugs because, to feel good. I use drugs because I enjoy them, because all my mates use them, and to manage painful feelings or obsessive thoughts. And I'll write this down, and then I'll hand the client a piece of paper, and I'll say, right, I'm going to be the client, and I'd like you to be the counsellor. And we'll role reverse, and I'll say to the client, who is now the counsellor, I use drugs to manage my anger. And hopefully the client will give me some guidance and advice back. The client finds a solution to their own problems. I'll also do a drug diary with the client. And obviously these tools and techniques are not used in one session. It's over a period of time amidst your listening and your normal counselling skills. So I'll ask them to do a drug diary of when, day and time. What were you thinking at the time? And this client's put, life is crap, I am worthless. And what were you feeling? Stressed. What were you doing? I was sat in my room. Did it help temporarily? Notice also that the client has said, I was home alone. I was sat in my room. This is where you may want to highlight that loneliness may be feeling. Maybe a feeling when he uses drugs. So you may say, I'm curious too, if you were feeling lonely, sat in your room. And if he was, then lonely would be the feeling that he may want to add to the list. When exploring the diary with the client, this is when you both may find a pattern or a theme to their use. We can then look with the client at alternatives. What else can they do when they're lonely or stressed? Helping the client to find healthier coping strategies. So we also need to look at triggers. A good initial plan for people who are starting off with changing their drug use is to avoid the risky situations and triggers to the use. And this may seem obvious, but for example, some people go to the pub after only a few days of not drinking and think that willpower alone will stop them from having a drink. Often we don't notice the triggers because they're just there in our everyday life. This is why it is important at this stage to explore the client's triggers to their use. It is important to remember that willpower alone does not work. They will need a toolkit to manage the difficult situations that they may find themselves in. If they place themselves in a risky situation without the skills and tools to cope with the situation, then they're at risk of relapse. So we will do a trigger chart, and we'll try and cover and look at everything that may trigger the client to use. So we'll look at the behavioural things, So all the things that the client does that may trigger them to use, which may be social withdrawal, watching TV, walking the streets, whilst on the computer. Those of you that are smokers might remember triggers to your smoking when you poured a cup of coffee, when you're answering the phone. They're all behavioural triggers to a user's use. Then, of course, there's the emotional triggers, all the things that they feel that they may trigger them to use. Stress, hurt, depressed, anger. Their cognitive triggers, all the things that they think that may trigger them to use. I'm worthless, no one loves me, I will never get a girlfriend, everyone is out to get me. They're just some examples. Then the visual triggers, all the things that they see that may trigger them to use. The dealer's house, paraphernalia, the drug, the mates. And then environmental, all the places that they may go that may trigger them to use. Pub, park, Fred's house. And their senses, all the things that they taste, smell, hear that may trigger them to use. Music, cannabis, coffee, alcohol. The client will not have explored their drug use to this in depth. They may just know the emotional triggers. So it's really important, because once they stop, if they have not got all their triggers covered, then they are at risk of relapse. One of the things that I say to clients is that if you've got money in your pocket and you feel like you want to use, make sure that you always carry an envelope, a stamped addressed envelope, to yourself in your pocket. Put the £20 in the envelope and post it to yourself. You'll get it back the next day, and that will help you to avoid using on that day. So once the client has detected and explored all their triggers, then we look at how they may be able to avoid or manage the trigger. So for example, walking the streets is a trigger. Maybe about avoiding this for a while. Stress is a trigger. Meditation, a bubble bath, or check out what techniques the client might find useful when they're stressed. The thought I'm worthless. It's when they can use the CBT tool that I'm going to teach you today, which you can teach to them. The dealer's house. How about walking a different route? Park. Avoid this for a while. Music. Wonder if reading a book instead might help. Some things you may completely need to avoid, but there will come a time when you'll be able to walk down that street and manage. So, this information can facilitate a treatment plan with your clients. So all the information they've given you about the reasons for using drugs, I used drugs before, their triggers to using drugs, can inform your treatment and which way you'd like to go with the client. She or he has told you all the things that trigger their drug use. So with any model, you can work in whatever way that you normally work with that particular issue. So if you're person-centered, you know what their conditions of worth may be from that information. If you are CBT, the thought process that triggers their use. If you are psychodynamic, what their internal processes may be. Although you may not be a directive therapist, you are then able to use your own style and model to work with this. So, for example, once we've explored their drug use, we can then help them with healthier coping strategies. So if they use drugs for anger, then anger management. Anxiety management, assertive training, communication skills, depression work, grief work, perfectionism work, relationship work, trauma or abuse work. Using the tools and experience from whatever models you are trained in, whether that be person-centered, CBT, solution-focused, transaction analysis, and so on. You know, we all use coping strategies to manage pain. some healthy, some not so. These clients are no different to all of us, or all of your other clients, other than they use substances as their go-to, as their coping strategy. So we'd be working in exactly the same way as we would with any other client and helping them to find healthier coping strategies. The CBT cycle. This is a technique that you can use with clients, and I find to be extremely powerful with all clients as well as drug users, to help them to challenge their irrational thoughts. So I'll draw out this cycle, and I'll use the thought that our previous client had that was a trigger to his drug use. The world is a crap place to live in. I am a worthless person. I will ask the client, when he's thinking this, how does he feel? He may say angry, frustrated, and depressed. I will then ask the client, and what's going on physically for you? He may say lethargic, insomnia, irritable, panic attacks, anxiety. And I say, when the world is, your thoughts, the world is a crap place to live in, and you think that you're a worthless person, and you're feeling angry, frustrated, depressed, physically you feel lethargic, insomnia, and irritable, what do you do? And the client will perhaps say, use drugs, isolate self, lash out. I'll then ask the client, which starts first? The feelings, the physical symptoms, the behaviour, or the thoughts? Now, some may say the feelings, because the feelings are always far more powerful than the thoughts. So if they do, I'll cover the feelings and say, if you didn't have those feelings, would you have that thought? And they often say, well, yeah, I'd still have the thought. So if we take away the thoughts, putting your hand over the thought box, would you have those feelings, physical symptoms, and would you behave in that way? And often the client will say, no. So I explain that the thoughts will trigger the negative feelings and subsequently the behaviour, which in turn may set them up for further pain, reinforcing the negative thought process. So if they've done that full circle, of course they're going to think the world is a crap place to live in, and that they're a worthless person. So in other words, wonky thinking leads to wonky feelings, and these produce unhealthy behaviours. So I will teach the client that they have exit points, and as you can see on this diagram, there's four exit points. The best exit point to use is the first one, stopping the thought in its tracks. And I will use imagery with the client to check out those thoughts, which I will share with you later on in these slides. Occasionally, they're not quick enough, the imagery doesn't work, and the feelings kick in. And I'll explain to them that you can only have one feeling at the same time. So if you're feeling angry, you can't feel happy. If you're feeling happy, you can't feel sad. So what we need to do is try and change that feeling. There's lots of things that you can do to do that. Relaxation, watch a comedy. If you're feeling unhappy when you're laughing, you won't feel unhappy. Equally, just like if you're feeling happy and you watch a sad movie, we end up sad. Read a book or watch an action pack box set. If the physical symptoms, however, have kicked in, and they forgot to use the techniques and tools at the feelings exit point, then they will need to do something physical to calm those down. Relaxation, watching a comedy might not be strong enough. So that would be where you go for a walk, go to the gym, run, clean. Some people clean their houses from top to bottom when they're like this. And that calms down the physical symptoms. If you've gone the full circle and acted out on all those thoughts and feelings, then be compassionate with yourself. This is every human being's process, and at the end of the day, you are just a human being. On the previous slide, I taught you that when having a negative thought, the exit point imagery is really useful to use to challenge that thought. I'm going to teach you that now. I find it to be very powerful, and you might want to use it yourself. So if you think about a negative thought that you have, and run along with me and see if it's useful for you too. So you can use imagery for challenging all your negative thoughts. But firstly, I need you to think about someone famous. This may be an actress, politician, sports, personality, comedian that you really do not like, that you think talks a lot of rubbish. Bear in mind, this will be your perception. I'm sure you can imagine which politicians are coming up in my exercises with clients at the moment. Somebody that if this person entered the room, you would walk out because nothing she or he said would be interesting, honest, or make any sense. So my example is Janet Porter. Now I'd like you to think of someone who you admire and feel talks a lot of sense. Someone who tells you the truth, who speaks honestly, and someone who you could sit and listen to for hours. And my example is Cheryl Cole. The first person in my example, Janet Porter, is my negative thoughts, my critical self, my internal bully. The second person in my example is Cheryl Cole. She is my positive thoughts, my nurturing self, the one that will challenge bullies and challenge the things that are not the truth. Therefore, when a negative thought comes into your head, before believing it, ask what your nurturing self would say. It will in most cases be kinder. So for example, sometimes I get up in the morning and I look at myself and I think, oh God, Linda, you're getting old. That's Janet Porter talking. Before I believe that thought, I say, what does Cheryl Cole say? And she'll say, yeah, you're getting old, Linda. Everybody gets old, but you're a cracker for your age. If I held on to that message, internal message of Janet Porter, I would feel depressed, lethargic. I'd go to work and be a bit snappy. But once the second person has challenged that thought, then I go to work feeling happy and I have a better day. So with my clients, the world is a crap place and I'm worthless, I would say, so what would Cheryl Cole say? And he would give a more nurturing answer. And then I'd say, so why are you listening to Janet Porter? And usually they laugh. I encourage my clients to download pictures of the nurturing person, so Cheryl Cole in this example, and post them around the house to remind them to challenge the thought and also to use when a negative thought is triggering them to use. And the reason I do that is because often when clients leave the therapy room, they forget the tools and techniques that you've given them. And if they've got Cheryl Cole or somebody similar around the house, that will remind them to challenge the thoughts. So by this time, they've got their self-esteem tool up on the fridge and the wardrobe door and the bathroom, and now they've got their Cheryl Cole or their positive person around the house. Another useful tool to do with a drug-using client is a timeline. And looking at the timeline of the client's drug use and also their life experiences, because from my experience, 9 out of 10 times you will find a link between their substance misuse, their substance change or increase around painful experiences. So for example, this client, his parents separated when he was 12. Dad went off, never seen him again. Then when he reached 17, he had his first girlfriend, and after several months, he was dumped. And then when he was 22, Mum had had enough of his drug use, had enough of him perhaps stealing money, so she rejected him. Interestingly, he started using cannabis at 12. Even more interesting is he started smoking heroin, a stronger drug, at 17. And at 22, he started injecting heroin. So the timeline will tell you something. The timeline will give you information. And this tells me straight away that rejection is a very painful emotion for this client. So therefore, when he feels real or imagined rejection, then this would be a big trigger to use. And so bringing the client to awareness of this will help him monitor his drug use and look at, listen to his feelings, listen to what's going on for him, and be able to perhaps manage rejection more often. What's really, really important is that when you've explored the client's drug use, you help the client to find alternative coping strategies. The client has possibly been using substances to manage thoughts and feelings for quite some time and may not have other coping strategies. We learn coping strategies as we grow up. So, for example, you know, our first row with our mum, we go to a youth club, we go to a dance, and we come home feeling better. Sometimes these clients' first coping strategy has been a joint. And so that's the only coping strategy that they know. It's important, therefore, to help them find healthier coping strategies for when they're triggered to use. To take away the substance without alternative coping strategies leaves them at risk of relapse. Equally, these would need to be put in place before you work with any underlying trauma, pain, or painful issues. To not do this would leave the client at the risk of an increase in their substance rather than a decrease. So if you've got a client that's had trauma as a child and you take away their drug before healthier coping strategies are put in place, then they have nothing to manage these painful feelings. It can leave them at risk of suicide as well. So once this work has been done, then we can look at the client doing a reduction plan. And this is all before you start working with underlying trauma or painful childhoods. Another tool that you can use in your work with clients when they're ready to start to change and when they've got some healthier coping strategies in place is a reduction diary. And this is an example of one for 10 joints a day. So as you can see, he smokes 10 joints a day, and on week 1, Monday 10, 9, 10, 8, 9, 10, 8. So reduced by 6. So the idea is to do a small reduction so that we can see if any painful stuff or underlying stuff comes up while they're doing the reduction, and they're in therapy with you, and you can work with that. Week 2 again, just a small reduction. Week 3 and week 4. Even though those are small reductions, the client is reduced by 53 joints at the end of the month. At a pound per joint, that is a saving of £53. This can be used for cannabis and alcohol reduction. However, heroin use will need support from the drug team for maybe a detox or substitute medication. And that's because when people come off heroin, they experience really horrendous withdrawal symptoms. So that has to be done medically as well as psychologically. Alcohol must be reduced and not just stopped, as to stop abruptly can lead to seizures. So it's really, really important that if you've got an alcohol user, that he doesn't or she doesn't just stop, that a reduction plan is put in place. Going back to this one, it's worth asking the client if he felt any different when he reduced from 10 to 9 joints, and you will often find that they don't. It is the first couple of joints that manage their trigger, their emotions or thoughts, not the 9th or 10th, so in fact they did not need those extra joints. And that's often something that clients don't realise when they're using. Ambivalence. Many of this client group can be quite ambivalent about change. I want to one week and I don't want to the next. Equally, I want to one minute and I don't want to the next. Ambivalence is a reasonable place to visit, but you wouldn't want to live there. It's a normal aspect of human nature. Passing through ambivalence is a natural phase in the process of change. It's when you get stuck in ambivalence that problems can persist and build up. And ambivalence is common in substance misuse work. To explore the client ambivalence is to work at the heart of the problem of being stuck. Until you can help the client to resolve the I want to, I don't want to dilemma, change is likely to be slow going and short lived. And often this is when key workers, drug workers, counsellors become quite frustrated with the client. The thing is to stay with, just be with the stuckness, just stay with the stuckness, because the client will shift. If the client is in this place, then the question to ask is not, why aren't you motivated? Why don't you want to change? Why are you saying you do want to change and on the other hand you're saying you don't? But rather, well, what are you motivated to do at this time? Motivational interviewing techniques are useful if you have an ambivalent client, so it's worth having a read through some of that online. I thought it might be helpful on looking at ambivalence and sabotage to share with you a case study of a client that was ambivalent and regularly sabotaged treatment. So we'll call this client Fred. And he'd been in for a detoxification of heroin about 5 times. Now, bearing in mind these detoxification programs cost thousands of pounds. And each time he'd remained clean for about 2 months. And then he'd relapsed. And he wanted to have a detoxification again. However, his key worker referred him to me to explore with him what had gone wrong on his previous attempts. He was very ambivalent, where part of his wanted this, but the other part of him didn't. So he came into to the therapy team and I saw him. I explored this with him, and what we learned through exploration like we've just done today is that when he was using heroin, all his family were around every day, paying him attention, doing things for him, helping him, doing his meals, doing his washing, because they knew he wouldn't, helping him to pay his bills and giving him lots of affection and, of course, lots of negative attention about his drug use. However, when he had recovered and left hospital and was abstinent, he didn't see them as much. They left him to his own devices to sort his own life out. It would have actually been more helpful if his family had done things the other way around. However, I could see what was happening. While he was using drugs, they were worried about him. They were rescuing him and became very hands-on in trying to help him, which must have been quite exhausting. But once he had stopped using drugs, they could get on with their own lives. They didn't have to rescue him. They didn't have to check on him, do for him anymore. Felt that they did not have to run around after him anymore. So they were relieved. However, for Fred, he became lonely during these times. He felt that no one cared. He missed the attention. Negative attention is better than no attention. So when he was all alone, all these feelings and negative thoughts would resurface. And so he would sabotage his treatment just to feel cared for again and have the company that kept him busy and stopped him from thinking and feeling. Because, of course, busyness stops you from thinking and feeling. When you're in a social group, it stops you from thinking and feeling. However, this was all on an unconscious level until therapy brought it into conscious awareness. And once this came into his awareness, Fred was able to see this and communicate this to his family. So with this exploration of his ambivalence to change and sabotage of his treatment And of course, some troubleshooting, exploring alternative coping strategies, as described earlier, it made his sixth attempt at recovery a successful one. So, when do we work with the underlying issues to the client's drug use? Some of them you'll be working with the work that we've already talked about, but the more traumatic ones, then the drug use needs to have stopped, and the client needs to be stable, and the client needs to have good, healthy coping strategies in place. So once the client is stable and free from substances, if you are not, of course, offering time-limited counselling, and the client has healthy coping strategies in place to manage difficult feelings and pain that may come up, then this would be the time to work with the client's painful underlying issues in the same way as you would any other client coming to you for help. Remember, to do this whilst they are still using could increase their use, particularly if these are traumatic history of abuse. Thank you for listening. I hope that this podcast has given you some level of understanding of substance misuse and given you some tools and techniques to work with this issue if a client presents to you with a substance misuse problem. If you would like further information on working with clients in substance misuse, please refer to the webpage for further links and resources. Thank you for watching. Remember to claim your CPD certificate for this presentation.